From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, an agreement on Ukraine, but will the protesters back down? Heartbreak in South Korea as families of the victims of a capsized ferry struggle to deal with their loss. Christians observe Good Friday. We'll get a report from Jerusalem. A number of mountaineering guides die in an avalanche on Mount Everest. South Africa's ANC party is strong but losing some support. It's all ahead. I'm Dave DeForest. Pro-Russian protesters in eastern Ukraine are refusing to leave their barricades despite demands from all sides for them to leave state buildings. The United States, Russia, the European Union, and Ukraine issued a joint statement at talks in Geneva Thursday calling for an illegal armed group to disarm and seized buildings to be vacated. Henry Ridgewell has a report from London.
Slavyansk in eastern Ukraine is one of the most heavily defended towns that have been taken over by pro-Russian separatists. Here, armed gunmen still patrol the streets. Barricades are being fortified. Despite the calls from all sides in Geneva for the protesters to leave state buildings, the demonstrators say they are beyond the point of no return. Alexander is a local railway worker. Slavyansk is now besieged from all sides, he says. There is the army all around, and we are going to stay here until the very end. Now we are demanding federalization. We want to have a referendum, and we want people to vote themselves and to make their choice with no Russian troops, no one here. But if something starts, we will ask Russia to intervene to help us have a referendum. At the Geneva talks, Russia again denied it had any involvement in the uprisings, but Moscow said Thursday it reserves the right to send its troops into Ukraine. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insisted it was not an option they wanted to use.
У нас нет никакого желания вводить наши войска на Украину, на территорию дружественного государства.
He said we have no wish to put our armed troops in Ukraine, on the territory of a friendly state, on the territory where our brothers live. This goes against the core interests of the Russian Federation. A joint statement issued after the Geneva talks called on all sides to refrain from violence, intimidation and provocative action. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned of more sanctions if Russia failed to act.
We fully expect the Russians, as they said they would here today, to demonstrate their seriousness by insisting that pro-Russian separatists who they've been supporting lay down their arms, leave the buildings, and pursue their political objectives through the constitutional processes that the agreement guarantees.
Analysts say the prospect of more sanctions is already hurting the Russian economy. Moscow warned this week its economy might show 0% growth this year due to the crisis. But many global companies are lobbying against sanctions, says Ben Kumar, analyst at London investment management firm 7IM.
You have this globalization now that means everyone is linked to everyone else. Companies like BP, all of the other major energy companies are so multinational that if you start threatening to shut down trade links, they will kick up a fuss.
The West is backing threats of sanctions with a show of military force. Canada is sending 6 fighter planes to the region to help bolster NATO defences. NATO has ruled out military intervention, but says the deployment is aimed at reassuring allies in Eastern Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A day after talks in Geneva about the Ukraine crisis, leaders in that country are still unsure about Russian intentions. Jamie Detmer reports from Kiev.
Ukraine's foreign minister, Andrei Desitsa, repeated concerns also voiced by US President Barack Obama on Thursday regarding Russian promises to help de-escalate the tense standoff in eastern Ukraine between Moscow-backed separatists and a government in Kiev.
I don't know what President Putin, Russia has in mind regarding the eastern Ukraine. However, we still believe that there is diplomatic means to de-escalate situation.
The foreign minister had just returned to Kiev from Geneva, where top diplomats from the United States, Russia, Ukraine and the European Union struck an agreement on a series of steps to tamp down violence and political unrest in Ukraine's restive east. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's denials that Moscow has fomented the unrest and sent intelligence operatives in to coach and assist the separatists made the day-long negotiations in Geneva tougher, say Ukrainian officials. Of his Russian counterpart, Desitsa says,
"He was cooperative and aggressive at the same time."
The deal sketched out in Geneva provides amnesty for separatist protesters who evacuate government buildings in a dozen cities in eastern Ukraine they've occupied, except for those found guilty of capital crimes. All illegal groups are required to disarm as well. It also outlines a commitment by the government in Kiev to transfer more power to regional authorities. But the first wrinkles have already appeared. Defiant pro-Russian militants say they won't leave government buildings they are occupying until Ukraine's interim government quits or until Ukrainian security forces have been pulled back. On Thursday, Ukrainian forces engaged pro-Russian separatists in the most intense clash yet in the crisis, killing 3 militants and wounding 13 after separatists attacked a military base in Mariupol, a southeastern port town on the Sea of Azov. Ukraine's foreign minister isn't alone in doubting the Kremlin's promises to help defuse the crisis. The country's economy minister, Pavlo Sheremeta, also harbours doubts about the Geneva deal.
I think we share President Obama's concern yesterday that he said that we are unsure what it all means, especially for Russia. We will see. We will see too. So we are not terribly excited about it. It's much tougher, you know, to kid us into some kind of memos nowadays.
But he adds,
even the war of words is much better than the war of bullets.
Even if the deal holds and the separatists accept it and leave the buildings they have seized, more challenges remain ahead. Ukraine's foreign minister says there was much they could not reach an agreement on in Geneva.
We also discussed the issue of the Ukrainian constitution, the issue of the so-called federalization or decentralization, as we call it. We also discussed the issue of the Russian language. We also discussed the issue of the Russian involvement into the activities in the eastern Ukraine. Those are the issues that we did not get an agreement to discuss more deeply and get a consensus.
President Obama says the United States is ready to impose fresh economic sanctions on Russia if the Kremlin doesn't make good on its Geneva commitments. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
Efforts to rescue some 270 people from a sunken passenger ferry in South Korea were hampered for a third day Friday. Anxiety and anger are growing among relatives of the missing, most of them high school students. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Jindo.
Workers at Pangmok Harbor try to console a parent of one of the missing high school children believed trapped inside the capsized ferry. Despite earlier reports of success, rescue divers failed in a third day of attempts to get to passengers inside the ship, just 20 kilometers offshore. Oxygen was pumped into the ship in hopes it would reach any survivors. Divers later tried entering a cargo hold, but were not able to go further in a struggle against wreckage, strong currents, and murky water. Hundreds of volunteers and emergency workers at the harbor tried to comfort distraught relatives, angry at the lack of progress and misinformation. Parents of the missing demanded a road be cleared for any who might be rescued. Authorities quickly obliged, marching in a column of police. Lee Min Sok is a rescue team captain with the Mokpo firefighters. He says the police presence is to keep crowds away, so roads are clear enough for ambulances to pass through. Several ambulances were readied nearby with flashing lights, but the display was cold comfort. Many realize the odds of surviving this long in the waters of the sunken ship are quite low, and the body count is expected to rise. Police say on Friday, a teacher of the students who was earlier rescued from the ferry apparently committed suicide and was found hanging from a tree. Authorities have prepared cranes to try to lift the ferry, but relatives demanded they wait until there is certainty that none are alive. Government, volunteer, and donor tents and food trucks are wrapped around the harbor. Sejun Beck is a Salvation Army officer. He says they are preparing food for about 500 people every day. They are also cooperating with other volunteers as well. It is still not certain what caused the 6,300-ton ferry on Wednesday to sink. Authorities are looking at the possibility the ship hit something in the water or a sudden change in course caused a dramatic shift in cargo balance. The ship captain is also being investigated. Korean authorities say he had put another crew member at the wheel during the disaster, and reports say the captain was among the first to abandon ship. Surviving passengers say the crew instructed them to stay put, and it was at least half an hour into the disaster before they were told to escape. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Jindo, South Korea.
In Nepal, at least 12 mountaineering guides have been killed in an avalanche that swept down Mount Everest. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
It was early Friday when the deadly avalanche hit guides who had set out early to ferry supplies and make preparations such as fixing ropes for foreign climbers. Dipendra Podal at Nepal's Tourism Ministry's Mountaineering Department says all the victims were local mountain guides.
It was this morning, 8:30 a.m. It was the avalanche and buried all the people. And the climbers were taking some kitchen items for the above camp, but like there was no any foreign climbers. The avalanche was happening between the base camp and the first camp.
More than 50 people, including the army and police, joined the rescue effort on the high mountain slope. At least three guides were pulled out from under the snow and were taken by helicopter to Kathmandu. Mountaineers say the avalanche struck at a relatively low elevation on the world's tallest mountain in an area known as a popcorn field. Friday's accident is the worst in recent times. In 1996, eight climbers were lost to a deadly snowstorm. Friday's disaster happened at the start of the climbing season on Everest and took place on what is called the South Col Route, which was used by the first men to conquer the 8,850-meter peak. The route continues to be popular with Western climbers. Podal says the base camp at Everest is crowded at this time of the year because a two-week window starting in mid-May is one of the best times to scale the peak. Mountaineers, local guides and support crews set up camp by this time to acclimatize.
More than 1,000 climbers are here at Mount Everest camp this time.
Over the years, the world's highest peak has become hugely popular and some say even too crowded. Over the last two decades, the number of annual climbers, mostly foreigners, has gone up from 100 to 500. Last year, there were reports that climbers had to wait their turn to descend or ascend the peak because nearly 150 reached the last stretch within hours of each other. More than 4,000 have scaled the summit since 1953 when it was first conquered. Hundreds, including climbers and guides, have died during the attempt. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington, sitting in today for Susan Yaki.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has won re-election, a result that paves the way for him to serve a fourth term. The Interior Ministry released official preliminary results today that show Mr. Bouteflika captured almost 82% of the vote. He faced five contenders in Thursday's election. Syrian state television and a human rights group say a car bomb in the central city of Homs has killed several people. The state television report says 14 were killed when the blast erupted outside a mosque in a pro-government district in the city. Worshippers were leaving the mosque after attending Friday prayers. Christians around the world are observing Good Friday, the day that Jesus was crucified. Robert Berger was on the scene in Jerusalem, where the events took place nearly 2,000 years ago, and filed this report.
Thousands Thousands of pilgrims packed into Jerusalem's old city for the traditional Good Friday procession. They marched through the narrow cobblestone alleyways of the Via Dolorosa, the Way of Sorrows, many of them carrying big wooden crosses. Singing hymns and reading from the Gospels, they retraced the footsteps of Jesus to the 14 stations of the cross. The faithful came from all over the world, including Michael Wade from Florida in the United States.
It's very nice to be here in a location where everything happened. It's one thing to sit in a church in the U.S. and hear about everything that happened 2,000 years ago, and it's a very different feeling to be in the place where it actually did take place. I think there's definitely much more of a connection.
Johanna Defar, who came from Ethiopia, said Jerusalem on Good Friday is a revelation.
You feel it, the agony of our Lord. You feel it, the agony. You feel it inside. So it's wonderful. So from now on, we feel our Lord's, not in word only, but even in his spirit, down in my heart.
It was a huge crowd this year as the calendars of the Eastern Orthodox and Western churches coincide, and they celebrate Easter and Holy Week at the same time. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A United Nations official in South Sudan says at least 40 people were killed in an attack on civilians sheltering at a UN base in Jonglei State. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the government has blamed UN peacekeepers for the violence.
The UN peacekeeping force, known as UNMISS, says an armed mob forced its way into the compound in Bor Thursday and opened fire at civilians taking refuge inside. UNMISS says peacekeepers returned fire, repelling the attackers. The head of office for the UN Humanitarian Agency in South Sudan, Vincent Lalay, told VOA the mob was apparently demonstrating against the UN at the gates of the compound before it turned violent. Lalay said demonstrators used powerful military equipment to force their way in.
Shooting started directly into an armed civilian, mainly women and children who had taken shelter in there.
At a news conference Friday, South Sudan's information minister, Michael Makwe-Lueth, claimed it was the UN who fired at the demonstrators first.
Before they could arrive, the UNMISS force shot at them, and as a result, it provoked a situation which resulted into that unfortunate incident.
Tens of thousands of South Sudanese have sought shelter at UN bases across the country since violence broke out in December following a political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar. In the latest fighting, opposition forces this week took over the town of Bentiu, capital of oil-producing Unity State. The government says the military soon will retake control. Lalay says more than 6,000 civilians have fled to a UN base in Bentiu in recent days, bringing the total number of people taking shelter at the base up to 14,000.
The fear factor is driving people out of their homes into a very, very difficult sheltering conditions in the UN base.
The U.S. State Department Thursday issued a statement condemning the recent violence and has called on all sides involved in the conflict to adhere to a cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January. That agreement has been repeatedly violated, while peace talks in the Ethiopian capital have stalled. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Nigerian military has retracted a claim that nearly all of the more than 100 schoolgirls kidnapped this week by suspected Boko Haram militants had been released. Nearly 100 are still believed to be missing. VOA's Ann Look reports from our West Africa Bureau.
The principal of the government girls' secondary school in Chibok, Asabe Kwanbura, said that 32 of the kidnapped girls have escaped. That's up from a reported 20 girls on Thursday.
Some jumped down inside the lorry. Some escaped within the camp.
The state education commissioner confirmed the figure, saying those 32 girls were safe and accounted for Friday. A total of 129 girls are thought to have been at the school when armed men arrived early Tuesday to take them away in trucks. The girls were only there to sit for final exams, as their school was among those closed in the Northeast in March for security reasons. Defense headquarters had released a statement Wednesday saying that all but eight of the kidnapped girls were free, something relatives of the girls and school authorities said was a lie. Most of the girls are still missing. The defense ministry spokesman issued a correction late Thursday, saying that his initial statement was based on faulty information and was, quote, not intended to deceive. But the fumble is a further blow to the military's credibility, as it faces mounting criticism for its handling of the insurgency in the northeast. Borno State Education Commissioner Musa Unoa Kubo told VOA the false report of the girls' release has only heightened their parents' impatience and apprehension.
When you come to the town, Nancy, all parents are in a mourning mood. Everybody is sad in the sense that there was a glimpse of hope when it was announced that they have secured the release, and up to now they cannot see the children.
Local vigilante groups and hunters have set out on what defense headquarters says is a, quote, frantic search for the girls in the dangerous forest near the Cameroonian border, where the girls are believed to be held. The military is also looking. No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, though many are pointing to the militant Islamist sect Boko Haram, which has attacked other schools in the northeast. The group has also reportedly been abducting girls and young women to serve as spies, cooks, and servants. Boko Haram has killed thousands in northern Nigeria since 2009. The group says it wants to impose a harsh form of Islamic law, which would include banning all forms of Western education. The kidnapping was one of three attacks this week attributed to Boko Haram, including a bombing in the capital, Abuja. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
Prolonged conflicts in Pakistan and Afghanistan are having a harsh effect on women. Sharon Bain takes a look.
During the past decade, women have made significant strides towards social, political, and financial empowerment in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. But analysts say the gains are being threatened. In Afghanistan, the Taliban are regaining areas of the country and once again imposing their beliefs that women should not be educated or participate in society outside the home. Nader Nadiri, director of the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, says in areas where there is an absence of rule of law, there is an absolute impunity for those who are committing violence, specifically against women. In those areas, he says, protection becomes a primary issue, but is often used against the women themselves.
In some cases, the protection issues becomes an excuse for the male members who intentionally prevents women to be part of the society, be part of the economy, be part of the politics, and they bring this issue of, I'm pushing you at the home because I want you to be protected. This is what the Taliban were trying to do and still are doing.
Pakistani social researcher Nazish Brohi says in areas where the Pakistani Taliban operate or have influence, girls are being targeted and women are retreating behind the veil and into their houses.
I think over 500 girls' schools have been bombed. Women counselors, which were women who were politically engaged, who were elected into office, they were specifically threatened by the Taliban and asked to either stop and withdraw from the political sphere or face persecution. Two of them were shot dead. As a result, the rest of the women either resigned or just simply stopped attending office.
In Pakistan's south and southwest, ethnic violence also has forced women to cover their faces and severely curtailed their social mobility. Brohi says with the overall deterioration of the rule of law in Pakistan, women no longer feel the state can protect them. Instead, they are turning to family or local neighborhood councils for help and protection.
The central concept really seems to be impunity, that the state is unwilling to call these aggressors or perpetrators of crimes into account because of A, its own incapacity, and B, its own unwillingness, and C, its general inefficiency.
But the analysts say in spite of the threat of violence or even death, women are still pushing forward in both nations. In Afghanistan, where women vividly remember living under Taliban rule when they were punished for leaving the house without a male relative or showing even an inch of ankle, Nadri says women are fighting against legislation that would erode their rights.
In each of those battles, the Afghan women have fought back. They were on the street, they were on the parliament house, they were at the office of president knocking on his door.
And in each of those battles, he says, the women won. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us on International Edition. I'm Dave DeForest, sitting in for Susan Yockey. Have a good weekend.